This is Conor Lennon from UN News. After more than 240 days, the Australian state of New South Wales is finally free from bushfires, officials there announced last week. But the massive wildfires have scorched millions of acres in the country since July of last year, and Australia remains highly vulnerable to further natural disasters. In an interview with UN News, Jennifer Pearson, wildlife program leader at the Tinbinbilla Nature Park, just outside the capital Canberra, said that climate change needs to start being integrated in conservancy programs and more genetic diversity management is needed. Ms. Pearson began by telling Julia Dean from our UN Information Centre in Canberra how the park was evacuated, which included removing close to 1,000 corroboree frogs and other endangered animals.
So it took us about 36 to 48 hours. So basically we had staged everything to the point that by the time we actually got the trigger to fully evacuate, we were prepared and were able to get out close to 1,000 northern corroboree frogs. We got out 526 brush-tailed rock wallabies.
Which are endangered.
Yes. So both of those are critically endangered. And then 26 eastern bettongs.
And how many people?
Well, the people we have, we had a lot of people on staff, but then there was lots of fire people coming in. So, yeah, and we had folks from town. So there was lots of, internally we got an incredible amount of support from across the agency to come in and help do this.
And what about the actual stress of the animals, like water and making it, you know, how do you move a wild animal in that situation into transport? And I presume further on to somewhere else.
It depends on the animal. So the koalas were the easiest because, we call them pet packs or, the dog carriers, the crates. So we have different sized pet packs.
And they weren't up trees, obviously. They were somewhere else.
It was just our breeding koalas. So the koalas didn't get evacuated. They stayed on site. So again, in this situation, in an area that does have natural habitats like this, we're never going to be able to evacuate everything. And so what we did was we identified the animals that were, first of all, genetically irreplaceable from an endangered species point of view. And that was part of how we prioritised.
And just in terms of the ones that you are breeding here, is this one of the only places where you are breeding them?
Yeah, so eastern bettongs right now are just in a couple. Had to make sure that we had, the second population, we conserved the genetics that were brought over from Tasmania.
So you've got all these incredible people out helping these thousands of animals. Now, they went to different spots.
Mm.
And then they've just come back this week, have they?
Not all of them. So we're staging it coming back as well. And one of the things about these fires, it's incredibly emotionally taxing for other people working on it. But the other side of that, I think, is how inspiring it is, how people come together. Mm. Because when we actually had to start evacuating, I had phone calls from institutions across the country offering their help. And that's why this has all gone so well is, Taronga Zoo, Healesville Sanctuary, all the folks at Zoos Victoria, Mount Rothwell. And we've had incredible support from people. And even within the agency and people doing stuff. And so you have these moments where, on a normal day, there's, all these different things that come into play in terms of doing your job. And in that week, everyone just pulled together and did what we needed to do to try to get these animals out of here. And so it was incredibly uplifting and inspiring as well. Everything has gone about as good as we could hope, to be honest.
Yeah.
And like I said, we've had the return of the frogs, and on the way back in the cars, all the frogs were calling. So being that we can get them in place before breeding is part of the reason we wanted to, because it's really important, when they breed, that's our entire cohort for releases next year. We've been able to release, this year overall, we'll probably be able to release close to 1,000 frogs. And so our frog program is going so well that we're producing amazing numbers to get back out into the wild. When they started calling, we thought, oh my gosh, we need to get them back in their little home breeding tanks so that they can lay their eggs in peace. And those can just, not be disturbed in the same way of having to come back and forth between institutions and get the light conditions right and the temperatures right and all those things to make it so that we could give them the best chance of producing some good animals.
Obviously, the frogs need something to eat if they're in the park. What happened to native insects?
We were relatively lucky here at Tibbinbilla compared to Namadgi National Park. As you could see as we drove in, I think they've said maybe up to a third of the park is burned. But again, when you look at it, it's been a relatively patchy fire. So we do have a hot spot in the middle, and then we've got some kind of medium severity around there, and lots of green around there as well. And so the initial surveys that folks have been able to do here have indicated that there are some patches of habitat left amongst the burn, and we were very lucky in terms of the proportion of the park that burned. Namadgi is still being assessed, and that's probably an area that's going to be much more interesting to look at in terms of the biodiversity.
That's further south, isn't it?
It is just south of us. So basically this fire came from Namadgi. So like I said, Tibbinbilla has been, pretty lucky in the type of fire, because fire isn't necessarily all bad. It's one of those things where this landscape is, of course, very adapted to fire. And so the way this fire has burned within Tibimbilla, like I said, the animals still have access to some remnant habitat, and the areas that are a bit less severely burnt should be able to bounce back with that epicormic growth pretty well.
Do you think you're going to see more of this? Is the country drying, or people like yourselves, park rangers, etc., planning for that?
We are, and so climate change is something that we fundamentally have to plan for in all of these programs now, and I think everyone's starting to acknowledge that unfortunately this may be the new normal for us. And so how moving forward we start to manage programs like this, where we are trying to have species in natural areas, how do we mitigate that fire risk while still being able to provide these types of habitat is a huge question for our program. But in general, you know, how do we manage operationally in general when you have such a huge pressure in terms of fire and what it does in terms of, you know, how you do your core business while also dealing with evacuations or dealing with, you know, fire suppression and fire management. And so as an agency, we really have to think about how we add this layer of climate change and what that means for our core operations in terms of what the habitat looks like, but also the amount of effort it takes to have that much longer of a fire season and that much more pressure on staff to manage those fires. It's a really complex area, I would say, for us. And from a biodiversity management point of view, you know, all of our programs really fundamentally need to incorporate climate change. And I think that's where the programs we're running here, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is look at that capacity for species to adapt. That's why it's so important to actively manage the genetic diversity. It's one of our only tactics, really, when you think about it. If we want species to be able to adapt to changing conditions, they've got to have genetic diversity. If there's no diversity, there's nothing they can use to adapt. Adaptation is based on genetic diversity.
So do you think animals are starting to adapt to climate change?
I think some animals may be able to adapt to climate change. And I think, you know, the challenge is providing the opportunity to do that. And so let's say, you know, one thing species can do is shift their distribution. So if habitats are shifting in the landscape, species can also shift with them. But that also means habitats not being fragmented, habitat loss not happening. So there's a lot of different pieces of this that need to come together. With things like the frogs, we're trying to look at different thermal conditions and how they'll handle those. Grassland earless dragons are a really interesting one to look at, where they're already potentially at very high thermal limits where they are.
So, what are they?
They're a critically endangered lizard that lives in Canberra, and they're in the grasslands there. And so,
they're having trouble with the heat, or
it's getting very hot. And so, what you know, some University of Canberra has done some really interesting work looking at the thermal limits for that species a little bit. And so, with these changes, we need to understand how to manage habitat, you know, at a microhabitat level to provide shade, all these sorts of things, but also look at how distributions of animals might shift and how communities might shift. So we're all starting to understand the landscape is changing. You know, climate change will change how biodiversity looks for us. And what we need to do is to provide, I think, you know, both landscapes and species within those landscapes the best opportunity to adapt. And again, you know, that base level of biodiversity, you know, biodiversity is genes, species, and ecosystems. And that base level of genes is what allows everything else above it to adapt.
People listening to this, what could people do? What could everyone listening to this do?
I think one of the things that everyone can do is just, you know, everyone in their own personal lives can make their own choices about how they can start looking at things like climate change and how they might contribute to changing those things. And beyond that is just starting to help out with the natural systems a lot more. And again, we saw such an inspiring outpouring of community support, both financially and all the donations that people saw, all the wild carers trying to get out to wildlife. And I think, you know, really connecting directly with organizations that are tried and true. So, for example, ACT government has something called Park Care, and we're developing a whole bushfire recovery volunteer stream in that because so many people want to come help out on that. So I think look to, you know, your local area that you care about. I think, you know, looking local is always a really good thing, and there's some great local organizations that you can contribute to you know, like I said, either financially or, you know, with your time. Both those things are really what make a difference.